From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, on this Easter weekend, we discuss the story of Christ's crucifixion with John Dominic Crossan, a scholar of the historical Jesus. We'll look at how crucifixion was used as a form of capital punishment 2,000 years ago, and we'll examine how Christ's crucifixion has been used to justify anti-Semitism. And we'll hear from religion scholar Elaine Pagels. She says we pretend to live in a moral universe where bad things don't happen to good people. After her husband died in a hiking accident, she examined how Western religions deal with loss, tragedy, and evil. Also, reviews of the new film Flirting with Disaster and the TV sequel to the film To Sir with Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The bodies of all 35 victims of the crash of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown's plane in Croatia have now been recovered and taken to a temporary morgue at the airport in Dubrovnik. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
A U.S. military official said the remains of the victims are being prepared for shipment home, but he was unable to say whether that would take place today or tomorrow. He said a short, simple ceremony will take place at the airport before the remains of the crash victims are flown out. He also said official identification will take place only once the bodies arrive at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The crash Wednesday occurred in extremely bad weather conditions with poor visibility and torrential rain. An Air Force investigating team is still inspecting the wreckage site, but their efforts to determine the cause of the crash will be made more difficult by the absence of data recorders on the Air Force plane. Military aircraft do not have to comply with federal aviation requirements for such equipment. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Dubrovnik.
At the White House this morning, President and Mrs. Clinton planted a tree in memory of Brown and the other victims of the crash. The Clintons used gold-painted shovels to scoop dirt around the sapling, which was placed close to a tree planted last year, honoring the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. The president is en route to Oklahoma City at this hour for events to commemorate the bombing. He'll place a wreath at the former site of the Murrah Federal Building and speak at the dedication of a new daycare center across the street. He'll also meet with relatives of the bombing victims. The nation's jobless rate edged up 0.1% last month, in large part because 62,000 factory workers were laid off. Half of that decline was blamed on the impact of the recently settled strike at General Motors brake plants. Labor Secretary Robert Reich says the slight rise in unemployment in March is not a cause for concern.
The average for the first quarter was a little over 200,000 a month, and that is good. That's better than 1995. By and large, not nearly as good as 1994, but I think that the so-called Goldilocks recovery continues. It is not too hot to risk inflation. It's certainly not too cool to risk recession. We seem to be on a good path.
Rice says most of the new jobs created last month were in service businesses. A federal official says a typewriter found in Theodore Kaczynski's Montana cabin appears to be the one used to produce the manifesto and letters sent by the Unabomber in recent years. Kaczynski is being held on one felony charge while investigators continue to search the cabin for evidence that can be used in a more detailed case against him. The stock market is closed today in observance of Good Friday. You're listening to news from NPR. The State Department has agreed to pay nearly $4 million to settle a decade-long racial bias lawsuit. The department does not admit to discrimination in the settlement. The agreement applies to all black foreign service agents who have served since 1984. Russian troops have suffered heavy losses against Chechen rebels in continued fighting in the breakaway republic. Despite President Yeltsin's order to halt military operations last week, commanders say they are continuing special operations. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
These so-called special operations differ not at all from the full-fledged offensive Russia launched a month ago. More than 30 Russian soldiers were killed and 67 wounded in overnight fighting, and late yesterday, Chechen rebels reportedly shot down a Sukhoi Su-25 fighter bomber. News agencies report bombing and heavy fighting around several mountain villages where Chechen rebels are believed to be particularly strong. Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin is to chair the first meeting of a commission charged with settling the 16-month-old conflict. It will comprise leading parliamentarians and heads of some of Russia's regions, including the president of Tatarstan. Tatarstan's autonomous status is cited as a possible model for fellow Muslims in Chechnya, and the Tatar president is also reported to be a possible go-between in future negotiations. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A cruise ship has been towed to an Egyptian port after striking a coral reef in the Red Sea. The vessel had begun to take on water. The Royal Viking Sun was on a round-the-world trip that was to have ended later this month in Florida. Over half of the 560 passengers aboard are Americans. They'll be flown to Europe and then home. Pope John Paul donned a black cape and heard the confessions of ordinary Catholics at the Vatican today during observance of Good Friday. The pontiff is to take part in a traditional Stations of the Cross procession around the ruins of Rome's ancient Colosseum later today. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This weekend, Christians celebrate Easter, while Jews continue the Passover celebration. John Dominic Crossan has been examining how the story of Jesus' trial and crucifixion have been used to justify anti-Semitism. He questions the historical accuracy of the gospel story, which says the Jewish crowd called for Jesus to be crucified even after the Roman governor declared him innocent. Crossan says that this story took on a dangerous anti-Semitic tone after Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century. Crossan is part of the movement of scholars studying the historical Jesus, using history and anthropology as well as the Bible to understand the lifetimes and teachings of Jesus. The controversy over this approach is the subject of front-page stories in this week's Time and Newsweek. Crossan is co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, a group of scholars studying the historical Jesus. He's a former Roman Catholic priest and is now professor emeritus of biblical studies at DePaul University. His latest book, Who Killed Jesus, just came out in paperback. Last April, I asked him if the Bible says that the Jews killed Jesus.
In one sense, of course, you can never find anything in the Bible about the Jews killing Jesus. Jesus was crucified, and crucifixion was a Roman execution, and he was executed by Roman soldiers in the Roman manner of execution. But the key, if you wanted to zero in on one text more than anyone else, you'd have to go to Matthew's Gospel, where Pilate is insisting that this man is innocent. And the crowd, and this is only in Matthew's Gospel, the crowd says, "His blood be upon us and upon our children," which means we take responsibility for this execution. We consider it right to do it. We take responsibility. Then in Matthew's Gospel, Pilate washes his hands. So in effect, the responsibility is transferred from the Roman governor, who is going to conduct it, of course, to the Jerusalem crowd who have said, "His blood be upon us and upon our children." That is the lethal heart of the problem.
Do you think that the story that a Jewish crowd insisted on Jesus' execution, do you think that story is based in fact?
That a Jewish crowd called for Jesus' execution while a Roman governor insisted he was innocent, I would call pure fiction. Let me tell you how I can say that. Obviously, you can't prove a negative. You can't prove something didn't happen. And in any historical reconstruction, you never have absolute certitude. You have to make your best reconstruction. When I look at that scene, and I look at Pilate, for example, we happen to know a lot about Pilate from outside the Gospels. There's a lot of governors in the first century, and we don't know a thing about them beyond their name. But Josephus, again, in the second half of the first century, tells us quite a lot about Pilate, and the Jewish philosopher Philo in the first half of the first century tells us about Pilate. Philo, for example, says, he uses him as an example of a bad governor almost, he says he put many people to death without trial. Now, what does Josephus tell us? Two major items. He tells us that he had a rather nasty form of crowd control, that very often when people, unarmed protesters, came up to appeal for something, for example, something that he had done, like taking the images of Caesar into the sacred precincts of Jerusalem, when the unarmed crowd came up to protest, he simply surrounded them by his soldiers and ordered the soldiers to attack. This is the pilot now who meets with the crowd in the gospel and backs down. This same pilot is also told by Josephus to have been extremely insensitive, let me put it mildly, to Jewish religious beliefs and sensitivities. So when I look at Pilate as I know him from non-Christian sources, and I look at Pilate as I know him from the gospel sources, my final conclusion is no, I don't think Pilate acted like this or would ever have acted like this. And so I think the crowd insisting that we are responsible and Pilate handing responsibility for the death of Jesus over to the crowd is fiction. If you wish to call it sacred fiction, by all means, it is Christian propaganda, that is one Jewish group, Christians, appealing against other Jewish groups to the Romans. Yes, in answer to your question, it is fiction.
So you find it hard to believe that this historically happened because you can't believe that someone like Pilate would defer to the crowd if he really believed in somebody's innocence.
Exactly. And that is one half the argument. The second half is that it fits so neatly into what Christianity has to do. Remember that at this stage, Christianity is a small, relatively marginalized, powerless group struggling with other Jewish groups who probably have much more power than it has. And it is, as I said, creating propaganda, as it were.
Yeah, what do you mean by propaganda? That has such an ugly sound to it.
I don't quite know what other word to use, Terry. People have said to me, why don't I call it what it is, a lie? The reason I don't do that is in the first century, in one sense, everyone is doing this. Everyone is trying to present themselves in their best light. Jesus was crucified by Roman power. That creates an immediate problem for his followers. Because any time that they are known, for example, as Christians, when Tacitus tries to explain what's a Christian, he says it's a follower of Christ. What's a Christ? A Christ was somebody crucified by Roman authority. Then this must be a subversive group, right? This is the followers of somebody whom we executed for subversion. That's what crucifixion was. It was not just for any old crime. It was especially for subversion among the lower classes. So how do you explain that you're not a subversive group? Well, in our story, Pilate really wanted to let our Jesus off. And it was only that the crowd insisted. And so Pilate reluctantly gave in. I don't know what to call that. You could call it apologetics. That's a sort of a polite theological name that scholars use. We might call it today, to put it bluntly, spin. I call it propaganda because I think that's what it is.
How do you explain, though, to people that this story of the Jews insisting on the execution after Pilate says Jesus is innocent appears in the Gospels?
As a Christian, the Gospels are inspired. If you consider that inspiration means that God, as it were, is dictating to a secretary who is rather passive and taking it all down verbatim, then of course you could not say what I have just said. If you consider that inspiration, as I do, inspiration is an interaction between a divine and a human author, if you will, and that God has to work with the loves and hates, the prejudices and biases, the sexism and racism, to put it bluntly, of that author, then I think you can understand how in Matthew, but not in any of the other ones, because Matthew is fighting bitterly, and I think fighting a losing battle with other Jewish groups, extensive bitterness is present in Matthew, more than, say, is present in Luke.
And is Matthew the only gospel that this particular story appears in?
Yes, Matthew is the only gospel that says his blood be upon us and upon our children, and that Pilate washes his hands. There is in a gospel outside the New Testament called the Gospel of Peter, in which the washing of the hands appears, but not that statement, his blood be upon us and upon our children. So that is only in Matthew. And let me put it this way too, Terry. If you were to take the Gospels absolutely literally so that everything that's in there had to have happened, let's say you're reading it in a very conservative way, then you should also say that before noon, the people said, "His blood be upon us and upon our children," but the dying prayer of Jesus annulled that before 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Jesus prayed, "His Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So whoever the them are, they're already forgiven.
I think for so many people, religion is in part history, but it's also faith, a kind of faith that doesn't rely on a factual sense of history, but more on beliefs. What happens when the two come in conflict? I mean, have those ever come in conflict for you, your sense of what happened in history and your sense of faith?
They don't for me because, in one sense, I spent 20 years in a Roman Catholic religious order, and it was a medieval order, and the Middle Ages always insisted that reason and revelation are, in terms of what your terms, history and faith, could never contradict one another. So Thomas Aquinas never worried when he was reading the pagan philosopher Aristotle, he might find something in there that would contradict his faith. Faith for me is a fundamental interpretation of something. It is the rock bottom interpretation on which your life is based. It is never a fact. You look at Jesus, and you look at Jesus crucified, and if you're a Roman soldier, you say this is the death of one more insurgent, and count one for the Roman order, as it were. I would even call that Roman faith, Roman imperial faith. The Christian who looks at Jesus crucified and sees this as the salvific death of the Son of God is also making an act of faith. Neither of those acts of faith can be proved, but they are looking and interpreting an historical fact. Jesus existed. Jesus died, for example. But faith is an interpretation. It is, by that definition, beyond proof or disproof, unless, of course, you are silly enough to get faith mixed up with history and think it's based on some historical fact rather than an interpretation of a fact.
You make the point in your book that many Christians today don't take the story of Genesis as literal historical truth, that it's possible to be a Christian and believe in the scientific theory of creation and to read the Genesis story as a parable, as something that's supposed to tell us something about God, but not the scientific way that everything was created. But you say that ability to distinguish between parable and scientific truth or history, the ability to do that diminishes for a lot of people as you get closer to the story of Jesus's crucifixion and then resurrection.
Yes, it's almost as if there was a quarantine, a safety zone around the beginning of Jesus's life and the end of Jesus's life, which many Christians would not put, many at least liberal Christians, would not put around the beginning and end of the world, as it were. And it seems to me you have to have a consistent way of reading the Bible. You can't announce principles that there is inspired fiction in the Bible, which I think is true. And I see no reason why God would want to inspire only information or fact. Why couldn't God want to inspire fiction? The parables of Jesus, after all, are all fiction. That doesn't mean they're false. That may mean they never happened, if you want to put it that way. The stories, in other words, story of the Good Samaritan does not depend for its truth on whether a man was ever beaten up on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. A parable is something which is truer than fact. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And once you begin to realize that, then many of the parables in the Bible and many of the stories, I think, in the New Testament, in the Gospels, are best described as parables. They may be based on some history in the sense, of course, that Jesus did exist, but they're parables. That's the proper title for them. And parables carry truth, but they don't carry it in the same way that facts carry truth.
I'm wondering what it must be like for you to try to understand what happened historically in the time of Jesus from the vantage point of 1,995 years later. I mean, you know, we keep getting further and further away from the time of Jesus. And yet we're always still trying to understand exactly, you know, as we get further away, we're still trying to understand exactly what happened. So yes. kind of a problematic exercise, really.
It is. I think what has happened for us is that after the Enlightenment, we wanted to know about every story. Yes, but did it really happen? I think people, maybe in general, and maybe people who never have gone through the Enlightenment, can hear a story, get the point, and not actually ask, yes, but did the story actually happen? Somewhat the way you and I may look at a commercial message. We get the point, and we don't really ask whether the megastar, whoever, really wears these shoes or drives this car. We get the point. You should want to drive this car. I think in the first century, people knew when they heard a story that they couldn't really check up on it. If you heard the story about the divine birth, say, of Augustus, and you were for Augustus, and you thought he really had saved the Roman Empire, and he was a marvelous person, then you believed the story. You didn't really ask yourself, yeah, but I wonder if that actually happened. You heard it, I think, very much like you and I hear a commercial message. So in many of these stories, I don't think that it's a case that they took it all literally, and now we're so smart, we know to take it metaphorically. I think they took it very often, got the point, and didn't ask the question, is it literal or metaphorical?
John Dominic Crossan is the author of Who Killed Jesus? This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, a scholar of the historical Jesus. We asked him to tell us about the historical use of crucifixion as a form of capital punishment. I asked him how long crucifixion was used to execute people and for what crimes.
Crucifixion goes way back before the time of the Romans, back to probably the Carthaginians, hundreds of years before. But by the Romans, it was particularly for lower-class people, for subversion. They probably wouldn't bother, say, crucifying a thief or something like that. He'd be probably dispatched summarily in the barracks. Because crucifixion involved sending a small detachment of soldiers out to do a job. And for the Romans, you were crucified, of course, alive. And you were usually left on the cross as a sort of a permanent warning. You have to imagine the crucifixion site with the uprights permanently in place. So even if nobody was being crucified, it was a permanent site warning to keep the lower classes in line. When somebody was being crucified, they were usually left on the cross to be eaten by the carrion dogs or the carrion crows or whatever, because that was part of the horror of crucifixion, that you did not receive burial. It was a supreme penalty, as the Romans called it, like burning alive or being tossed to the beasts, not because you suffered more than any other way, but because you weren't given burial. And in the ancient world, that was sort of like an annihilation.
How long did it take usually to die on the cross?
That depended very much on how badly you had been beaten beforehand. And usually scourging, almost every time that Josephus mentions crucifixion, he mentions scourging with it. And probably the function of scourging was to reduce you to manageable format, as it were, so you would not resist and fight back. And so with blood loss and everything else, it mightn't be very long. But there are cases mentioned in stories of 3 days and 4 days, people still alive on the cross. And Josephus mentions a case of friends of his when Titus had destroyed Jerusalem. He found some friends of his crucified, managed to get them taken down, and some of them survived. So it is possible to survive crucifixion. Usually the only example we actually have of a crucified skeleton that's ever been found in the Jewish homeland had a nail still in the person's heel, and apparently the two heels were impaled on either side of the upright, and the person was tied. The arms were tied over the crossbar, not nailed to the crossbar. So in that case, you might be able to survive for quite some time.
In your book, you mentioned that sometimes the legs of the person being crucified were broken. What was the point of that?
If the legs were broken, the person would slump forward and no longer be able to push themselves up, as it were, by their legs and continue breathing. So they would die of asphyxiation. And so it was considered a mercy, if that is the proper term to use in such a horrible situation, that you at least were allowed to die swiftly rather than, you know, breathing laboriously until shock or whatever would kill you.
Other aspects of the story of Jesus's crucifixion that make more sense to you or are brought into a new light when you know a lot about the history of crucifixion as a form of punishment in ancient times?
Yeah, it's very hard for us to realize the horror of crucifixion. In one sense, we almost think of, well, it was just terrible pain for 3 hours. It was intended as the supreme, absolute humiliation, negation, annihilation of the human being. So that when Paul, for example, talks about the folly of the cross, the word he really uses, it's the root from which we get moronic from. It's the absolute stupidity of imagining that a crucified person could be the savior of the world. That would have struck the Greco-Roman mind as absolutely incredible. Not that he had died, not that he'd been executed, but that he had been crucified.
What does the cross mean to you?
The cross would mean for me nothing except alongside the life of Jesus. The death of Jesus for me cannot be separated from the life of Jesus. Otherwise, you make a sort of a fetish of blood, as it were. So I go back to my own view of the historical Jesus empowering people to live a certain form of life, a life of egalitarianism, a life without discrimination or hierarchy, a life which I would call ethically correct, not just politically correct. And for that he died, because what he was doing and what he was saying was as challenging to the Roman Empire and to any empire we've ever known, including our own. And therefore, eventually such a person gets either executed, which was the way it was done in those days, or assassinated, which is the way it's done in our day. So it's that death along with that life that makes sense to me.
And is the cross a potent symbol of that life and death to you?
Yes, though I am a little bit worried about the fact that it can be separated. For example, you can focus just on the death without asking anything about the life, and then it may get a very strange phenomenon. It is as if the death itself was meaningful, irrespective of what Jesus did, and I do not find that. It's only the life and the death, the words and the deeds, everything put together that makes sense to me.
John Dominic Crossan's latest book, Who Killed Jesus, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, religion scholar Elaine Pagels, author of The Origin of Satan, considers how Western religions deal with loss, tragedy, and evil. Also, John Powers reviews the new film Flirting with Disaster, and David Bianculli reviews the new TV sequel to the 1967 film To Sir With Love. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elaine Pagels is a historian of the biblical era. She's the author of The Gnostic Gospels, which won a National Book Award. Her intellectual world was shaken by two personal tragedies in the late 1980s. Her six-year-old son died of a respiratory illness. A year and a half later, her husband died in a hiking accident. She says that after her husband died, she became aware that she was living in the presence of an invisible being. That is, she still felt her husband's presence. During the following years, she began to reflect on the ways that religious traditions give shape to the invisible world, and how what we imagine about the invisible world shapes our responses to events in the natural world. She also found herself reflecting on the ways that people from Greek, Jewish, and Christian traditions deal with misfortune and loss. This led her to write her book, The Origin of Satan, which will be published in paperback next month. Our interview about religious traditions and personal tragedy was recorded a year ago.
When people experience some unexpected misfortune, they often respond as if it's their fault or somebody else's fault or some, you know, the universe's fault or God's fault or something like that. And it struck me, although I'd never believed that, that this is like a cultural reflex, you know, that this conviction that somehow the universe has a moral structure. And when that accident happened and devastated my life, I was married to my late husband for 20 years, and it was quite extraordinary. I found that even though I didn't believe in that, you know, that it was anybody's fault, he was a physicist working on chaos theory at the time, as a matter of fact, certainly knew he didn't believe that. It was just dealing with an unexpected sort of universe. That came up as a kind of cultural reflex, and I found for me it was not helpful. And one thing I had to do with it was to look at the way I had learned culturally this kind of reflex.
Wait, what wasn't helpful? What reflex wasn't helpful?
The belief that it was somebody's fault that these things happen. Mm-hmm. And I needed to look at that and put it aside. And one way of doing that was to look at how that view came into our culture. That's one part of it. The book also came out of another kind of very visceral perception, which happens, I'm sure you know, when you suddenly lose someone you love very much, especially someone you're very close to and live with. Then it's as though the person is there, but they're not there. It's a very strange perception, and accommodating oneself to that loss is a very long-term process. And when I said I felt as though I were living in the presence of an invisible being, I didn't mean literally that I thought he was, you know, sitting over my shoulder, but simply that I was aware of his presence a great deal and then aware of his absence a great deal. And after that thought, you know, considerably later, I realized that in the ancient world, which I study sort of as a historian, virtually everybody thought that there were invisible beings in the world. Whether you were Egyptian or Greek or Babylonian or Jewish or Christian, almost everyone accepted that.
Now, where does Satan come in and what you were going through emotionally when you decided to write the book?
Well, I think the figure of Satan had to do with, it had to do with conflict, it had to do with distress to some extent, but also had to do with this cultural reflex that, as I said, was not at all useful, which leads a person to think when they have some kind of misfortune like this that, you know, that this is an evil thing or something bad is being done to them. And I started out looking at invisible beings, which for me meant the Greek gods, you know, like Hera and Zeus, Apollo, all of those gods. And then thinking that, but a Jew or a Christian wouldn't look at Greek gods. They were thinking about a universe in which there's a moral order, and it's ruled by God and his angels and so forth. Anyway, so I decided to look at the Greek gods and the angels and demons. Then I was very much surprised to discover that demons and devils are almost non-existent in Jewish tradition. They just aren't there until very, very late, almost until the time of the early Christian era.
When in Christianity you have, you know, Jesus representing, you know, a force of good and Satan representing the force of evil, is that dichotomy, that clear division between good and evil, something new?
It looks new to me. I mean, I don't know where else to find it in the ancient world. I mean, even in the God of Israel, one finds wrath, one finds blessing. But in that dichotomy, I think it is new. It's an interesting question.
Elaine Pagels is my guest, and she's a historian of the ancient world. Her new book is called The Origin of Satan. You've been studying the ancient world, studying the history of religion for many years. And I actually want to broaden this discussion into some work that you did interpreting ancient texts that were discovered very recently, back in the mid-1940s. I believe they're known as the Nag Hammadi Library.
Yes, that's right.
Before we talk about their writings about Satan and evil, these are Gnostic texts. Would you explain what Gnostic texts are?
Yes. Well, you know, agnostic means somebody who claims not to know about ultimate reality. A Gnostic is somebody who claims to have some knowledge. Gnosis is a Greek word for knowledge, but it doesn't mean intellectual knowledge. It doesn't mean like scientific knowledge or mathematical knowledge. It means a knowledge of relationship, like the kind of word you'd use do you know this person? Yes, I know that person. So it's a relational knowledge. I think maybe the word insight is better. So these are people who claim certain kinds of spiritual insight, but they also claim to be Christians who had insights particularly about Jesus and the disciples that were not given to everybody. In that find, there were 52 ancient texts that claim to go back to the beginning of the Christian era. There are gospels about Jesus. There are secret dialogues between him and disciples. There are letters from one apostle to another, the secret book of John, so forth.
Well, you've concluded that the Christianity may have been more diversified in its very early expressions than it is even today.
Well, I think it was, because when you look at these other gospels, you find that the range of traditions about Jesus is just enormously fascinating and diverse and interesting. And the difference of point of view and perception and opinion is also enormous. That was very much cut down when the church became an organized structure that could agree on unified doctrine all over the world. That's a rather late phenomenon by my standards. It took about 150 years after the death of Jesus, anyway.
Well, give us a sense of what Christianity was like in that 150 years before things were codified.
There were little groups all over the ancient world, from Spain to Africa to what is now France or England, Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, Persia, with very different kinds of rituals, different kinds of beliefs, different kinds of practices. Some were radically ascetic and thought one had to live in celibacy and renunciation and be vegetarian and abstinent in terms of alcohol and meat as well as sexuality. Others were completely different in their attitudes, and you can see them expressed in the Gospels of the New Testament. But so we have a picture of widely ranging sort of flourishing of a very diverse and interesting movement. What fascinated me was how that changed. And I think because of persecution by the state, it was necessary for many of these groups to consolidate and agree on what they believed and in a way become much more uniform.
You know what I find interesting? These ancient Gnostic texts that you helped interpret, you say that if they were found 1,000 years ago, they would have been destroyed as heretical.
Oh, they were.
Well, what was in them that would have been seen as heretical at the time?
Well, for one thing, some of them, as I say, have very different pictures of the God of Israel. I mean, some of them tell the story of Genesis as though the serpent were the divine voice, feminine divine voice, sometimes revealing the truth. And the God of Israel is sort of like an angry father who wants to prevent Adam and Eve from waking up and participating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge and spiritual understanding. So there's a contest between this God and the benevolent serpent who's trying to free Adam and Eve from their bondage. That's one kind of thing. But also, and I think much more threatening to what became the emerging church, there are pictures of Jesus here that look much more like a Buddhist view. That is, Jesus not as the only Son of God through whom you must be saved, but Jesus as one who shows the way to the divine source. But what Jesus shows is that you can find the way to that divine source by yourself and within yourself. And to suggest that means that you may not need a priest, you may not need a church, you may not need Jesus for that matter. You just need to go off by yourself in the desert and struggle and meditate and contend with yourself until you find the deeper self within. And that was something that many church leaders thought was blasphemy, was deprecating to Jesus, and absolutely wrong.
Do you find yourself more attracted to this early, more mystical, or more Buddha-like approach to Christianity?
I find myself very much attracted to it. Ever since I read those texts, I felt somehow that I was at home among these very strange flora and fauna. As I said, they are strange and wild, and my professors were saying, well, of course, you know, they're all blasphemy, and they're all heresy, and they're all quite ridiculous. And I was saying, you know, I love these texts, some of them. Some of them are funny. Some of them are sort of startling and unexpected. And others are just absolutely extraordinary. So, yes, I find myself very much attracted to them.
Tell us a little more what they are, when they're from, who wrote them.
We don't really know who wrote them. They probably come from about the 1st to the 3rd century. They're quite a diverse collection. The Gospel of Thomas looks like, and I think is, an early collection of Jesus' sayings. It may include some later sayings, but it's a very interesting early collection of the sayings of Jesus. Some of the ones I like very much are ones like this. Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. There are sayings like that that I found compelling as Zen koan.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thing you can ponder for a very long time.
Yes, that's why I wrote the Gnostic Gospels, because of that saying. But there are many others. For example, there's a wonderful poem called Thunder, Perfect Mind, and this comes from the Greek word bronte, thunder, which was seen by the ancients, whether they were Jewish or Greek, as the voice of the divine. Here the divine voice speaks as a feminine power, and she speaks in a very extraordinary way of the opposites inherent in her contradictory nature, which comprise the whole of being. It's a marvelous poem.
My guest is religion scholar Elaine Pagels. Her latest book is The Origin of Satan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is religion scholar Elaine Pagels. Part of what we turn to religion for is, I think, not only to explain things to ourselves, but also to explain things to children. I know you have children, and you lost your husband. You also lost a 6-year-old son a few years ago.
Yes.
To illness. Did you find yourself turning to religion at all to help explain these losses to your children?
Well, let me say this. What I was trying to say before is that it doesn't seem to me it helps much to try to explain these losses. One has to live with them, even though we can't explain them. At least I can't explain them. One has to live with them. And in living with them, living with the fact that they've happened, that they do happen, and they're not unusual, there I found meditation, for example, and prayer to be essential. And I've brought my children into that process because I think it's going to be essential for them as well in understanding, you know, how we can deal with our lives. So when I say it's not useful for explaining, I mean something kind of intellectual by explaining. You know, the mental explanation doesn't help me very much. But in living with some reality like that, I find these religious means essential.
What are your most fulfilling experiences in a place of worship?
That's an interesting question. Or outside of a place of worship, I would say hiking up in the mountains is one of them. Sitting in meditation with other people who deeply know how to do that. I was thinking of a monastery in Colorado, which has an extraordinary depth to it as a place to meditate. So, and the third would be the extraordinary music that comes out of Christian tradition, particularly for me. Some amazing music that I very much love.
You mentioned hiking in the mountains, and if you don't mind my mentioning
this,
I know your husband died in a hiking accident.
Yes.
And the fact that you would continue to hike and to feel that that was among your most spiritual experiences is really interesting. I mean, a lot of people would just be afraid to set foot on rocky slopes again after.
Well, that may be, but it was very much a kind of spiritual home that we shared. And I feel that those mountains are a remarkable place. When I do hike, I hike on trails and in places which have no drop-off. I don't take chances with my life because I know that sometimes, you know, we don't get a second chance with those things. And I have my children to be responsible to and my husband and the whole family.
Elaine Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University. Her book, The Origin of Satan, will be published in paperback next month. David O. Russell's first feature, Spanking the Monkey, was a small independent film about masturbation and incest. His new film, Flirting with Disaster, stars Mary Tyler Moore, Alan Alda, and Lily Tomlin. Film critic John Powers says Flirting with Disaster is far tamer in subject than Spanking the Monkey, but much wilder in style. Here's his review.
We live in a time when comedies tend to be about a single idea. You know, Adam Sandler goes back to grade school, or a group of drag queens descend on the Midwest. Movies like this are made to be marketed. Their jokes fit neatly into 30-second TV ads. Exactly the opposite is true of Flirting with Disaster. Its television spots are utterly excruciating, especially that bit where Mary Tyler Moore hoists her blouse and flashes her brassiere. But the movie itself is consistently funny and surprising. This is one comedy that delivers far more than it promises. Ben Stiller stars as Mel, a New York entomologist who was adopted at birth and feels unanchored because he never knew his biological parents. When the adoption agency gives him the name of his birth mother, he heads off to San Diego to meet her. He's accompanied by his wife Nancy, who's played by Patricia Arquette, by their baby son, who Mel can't get it together to name, and Tina, a neurotic shrink who wants to study Mel's reaction to meeting his parents. Of course, finding these real parents proves trickier than expected, and soon Mel, Nancy, and Tina are ping-ponging back and forth across the U.S., getting involved with anti-Semitic truckers and amorous FBI agents, superannuated hippies, and Reagan-worshipping Republicans, not to mention being chased down by Mel's adoptive parents, who are terrified that their son is in trouble. Meanwhile, Mel finds himself growing sexually attracted to the shrink, and his wife and one of the feds start to, but you get the point. Flirting with Disaster is one of those rare comedies that mocks any attempt to summarize it. Things start out crazy and keep getting crazier, spinning toward a peak of hysteria where nobody knows exactly what's going on, but everybody wants to have their say. On his way from Michigan to New Mexico, Mel stays at a hellish bed and breakfast, whose owner forbids guests to use the phone. But he sneaks downstairs at night and calls his adoptive parents, played by George Segal and Mary Tyler Moore.
Are you all right?
We're fine. It's just there was a big mix-up in San Diego, and then I ended up flattening a post office with a truck.
What truck?
Truck. What's happening with the truck? We had the wrong information, but we have the right information now. We're going to New Mexico.
New Mexico?
Tell them they got uranium in the water down there.
Shush, she's in some kind of trouble.
Like many filmmakers who make their name with a small-scale movie, David O. Russell wants his second effort to be about everything. The results are sometimes quite messy. By the final reel, Mel's quest has been largely lost in a roaring tornado of running gags, crazy crosstalk, mistaken identities, slapstick pratfalls, and slyly hip one-liners. But while Russell tries to juggle too many balls, his gaudy ambition is still exhilarating. Flirting with Disaster harks back to the delirious comedies of Preston Sturges or Pedro Almodovar, great sprawling canvases with scads of nutty characters and subplots that proliferate like termites. There are nifty jokes about carjacking, LSD, and the beauty of armpits. There's a gay couple whose introduction is so wittily done that I wouldn't dream of giving it away. And there's terrific work by the whole cast, especially Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda, as loosey-goosey survivors of the psychedelic era. Their blissed-out amorality makes them the perfect counterpoint to the bickering, fretful, upper-middle-class couple played by Siegel and Moore. Flirting with Disaster offers a satiric vision of a culture in which fathers won't name their sons until they've learned about their own childhoods. Shrinks can't help their patients because they're worried about their own inner lives. And parents don't hear what their children are saying because they're blinded by their own obsessions. It's a portrait of America as one vast dysfunctional family. And it's got enough good jokes for three movies.
John Powers is the film critic for Vogue. Coming up, To Sir With Love 2. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday night, CBS presents a sequel to the 1967 film To Sir With Love, which starred Sidney Poitier. The TV sequel is called To Sir With Love 2 and stars Sidney Poitier. TV critic Deva Bianculli has this review.
When I first heard that a sequel of To Sir With Love was being made by CBS, I cringed. When I heard that Sidney Poitier was playing the leading role again, I was a lot more impressed and interested. Then, when I learned that the director of the sequel was going to be Peter Bogdanovich, I was even more interested. Well, I've seen it, and there's some good news and some bad news. Part of the bad news is that Philip Rosenberg's script for To Sir With Love 2 is pure formula. Just like in the original movie, Poitier's Mark Thackeray is an idealistic teacher who respects his rowdy students, demands they respect him in return, and eventually wins them over. The good news is that 29 years later, that formula still works. The rest of the bad news is that Bogdanovich, who showed a remarkable understanding of teen angst when directing The Last Picture Show, doesn't bring much of anything to the party here. The only directorial flair he shows is in the pre-credits sequence, which alludes to the original film in a series of quick, almost ghostly flashbacks. And even that's a clumsy sequence because it rushes through a reunion featuring cameo appearances by Judy Geeson and Lulu, two stars of the original film. By the time Thackeray ends up in an inner-city classroom in Chicago, viewers have every right to be expecting the worst from To Sir With Love 2. But there's good news here, too, and it saves the movie. Just as Mark Thackeray single-handedly saves his otherwise failing students, Sidney Poitier saves this otherwise failing telemovie. His performance is so confident and so charismatic that he makes every scene work, even scenes where he's staring into a gun barrel, relying only on his wits and authority to protect him. Listen, for example, to the way Poitier delivers this speech, in which Thackeray is defending his students to the principal, played by Daniel J. Travanti from Hill Street Blues.
I've got to get an experienced teacher in there, Mark.
Experience? I have 28 years of teaching.
In London. And you're retired. Believe me, I can be drawn and quartered if I don't get somebody in there who knows these kids, knows what they're like.
You mean someone who's made up his mind what they're like without even meeting them? That's not experience, Horace. That's prejudice. And you know it.
For God's sake, Mark, you know me better than that.
The minute those kids were put in H section, their futures were closed. That's prejudice. They don't look bright and shiny like winners, so you settle for letting them lose. That's prejudice. I'm trying to open up their minds, Horace. But what good is that if your mind is already closed?
To Sir With Love 2 is a sentimental, idealistic drama. But so was the original. And so were Stand and Deliver and Dangerous Minds, two fact-based movies using the same basic outline. They all work for the same reason. If you're going to tell a story about a great teacher, it helps to have the teacher played by a great actor. Sidney Poitier was one in 1967. He's still one in 1996. And he's the reason To Sir With Love 2 gets a passing grade.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Roberta Shurrock and directed by Alan Tu. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the theme from To Sir With Love. Lulu had the hit. Here's Al Green's version.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, The Score. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Marga Gomez performs an excerpt of her new show, which pays homage to her father, a comedian, MC, and theater owner in New York's Spanish show business of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Also, mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.